he attained an exalted position by merging into the Lord's body. Certainly this was astonishing, and therefore Maharaj Yudhisthira inquired about the cause of the Lord's mysterious mercy to Shishupal. O great sage, we are all eager to know the cause for this mercy of the Lord. I have heard that formerly the king named Vena blasphemed the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that all the Brahmanas consequently obliged him to go to hell. Shishupal should have been sent to hell. How then did he merge into the Lord's existence? These are good questions. Text 18. From the very beginning of his childhood, when he could not even speak properly, Shishupal, the most sinful son of Dhammaghosa, began blaspheming the Lord, and he continued to be envious of Sri Krishna until death. Similarly, his brother Dantavakra continued the same habits. Although these two men, Shishupal and Dantavakra, repeatedly blasphemed the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, or Krishna, the Supreme Brahman, they were quite healthy. Indeed, their tongues were not attacked by white leprosy, nor did they enter the darkest region of hellish life. We are certainly most surprised by this. Purport. Krishna is described by Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita 10:12 as follows. I'm going to skip the Sanskrit. You are the Supreme Brahman, the supreme abode and purifier. Herein this is confirmed. Vishnam Yad Brahma Param Avyayam. The Supreme Vishnu is Krishna. Krishna is the cause of Vishnu and not vice versa. Similarly, Brahman is not the cause of Krishna. Krishna is the cause of Brahman. Therefore, Krishna is Parabrahman, Yad Brahma Param Yavayam. Text 20. We're almost there, guys. How was it possible for Shishupal and Dantavakra, in the presence of many exalted persons, to enter very easily into the body of Krishna, whose nature it is difficult to attain? Shishupal and Dantavakra were formerly Jai and Vijay, the doorkeepers of Vaikuntha. Merging into the body of Krishna was not their final destination. For some time they remained merged, and then later received liberations of Sairupya and Salokya, living on the same planet as the Lord in the same bodily form. The Shastras give evidence that if one blasphemes the Supreme Lord, his punishment is to remain in hellish life for many millions of years, more than one suffers by killing a Brahmana, by killing many Brahmanas. Shishupal, however, instead of entering hellish life, immediately and very easily received Sayuja Mukti. That such a privilege had been offered to Shishupal was not merely a story. Everyone saw it happen. There was no scarcity of evidence. How did it happen? Maharaj Yudhisthira was very much surprised. In the final verse, text 21. This matter is undoubtedly very wonderful. Indeed, my intelligence has become disturbed, just as a flame of a candle is disturbed by a blowing wind. O Narada Muni, you know everything. Kindly let me know the cause of this wonderful event. The Shastras enjoin Tad Vijnana Nartam Saguram Ivambit. Gachet, and I'm going to skip the Sanskrit. To understand these things, one must humbly approach with firewood in hand a spiritual master who is learned in the Vedas and firmly devoted to the absolute truth. When one is perplexed by the difficult problems of life, to solve them, one must approach a guru like Narada or his representative in disciplic succession. Maharaj Yudhisthira therefore requested Narada to explain the cause of such a wonderful event. All right. Om Agyana Timinandasa Gyananjala Shalakaya Chakshara Umilityam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Krishna Mano Vishtam Shtepiyam Yena Bhutale Svayam Nupa Kada Mayam Dadati Sva Padam Tika Nam Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swamin Iti Namine Namaste Sarasati Devi Gauravani Pacharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschacha Deshatanine Panchakalpa Turishcha, Kripasindu Evacha, Patitanam Pavebhyo, Vaishnebhyo Namo Namaha, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Aveta Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Okay. Do you think someone could grab me a cup of water? Yeah. Sorry about that. So once again, please bear with me. Like Michael yesterday, I'm just going to read an essay I wrote. Originally, I was going to give this PowerPoint, and I had all these plans, but I realized that was kind of impractical and that I don't have that potency. So I'm just going to hopefully read this essay and cover the points that Prabhupada brings up in his purports, though I kind of formatted differently. I'm mostly going to be talking about the demons and how Krishna deals with the demons, both impartially, indirectly and directly. Okay, so I'm going to start. I'm going to start with a little recap of what we've covered in this chapter so far. So Marj Pikshet has asked Sukadev Goswami about the apparent partiality of the Lord. How can Krishna be impartial if he helped Indra defeat the demons? Sukadev has explained this apparent partiality of the Lord is simply due to our materially contaminated vision. We cannot impose our material concepts on the Lord, for he is nirgun, without material qualities. He only appears partial due to the fluctuations of the three gunas. While sattva guna is predominant, it appears he's favoring the devatas. While Rajagun is prominent, it appears he's favoring the demons. And when Tamagun is prominent, it appears he's favoring the Rakshasas and other ghosts and ghouls, that sort of thing. It is by the time factor that these three gunas are constantly competing for dominance. While these energies of the Lord, Prakriti and Kala, are dependent on him, he is merely facilitating them, remaining aloof. So that brings us to today's verse. Sukadev is continuing to illustrate the impartiality of the Lord by narrating a conversation between King Yudhishthir and Narada Muni. Sukadev has given a philosophical explanation of Krishna's impartiality, and now he's going to give a historical example. King Yudhishthir was confused as to how, after being beheaded, the demoniac prince Shishupal attained liberation by merging into Krishna's body. Shishupal was a sworn enemy of Krishna and openly blasphemed him during the Rajasuya sacrifice. So how did he attain liberation? His brother Dantavakra, attempting revenge, also received the same result of merging into the Lord. Yeah, I'll slow down. This is pretty long, so you guys have to try to pay attention. Oh yeah, all right, I'll slow it down. All right. His brother Dantavakra, attempting revenge, also received the same result of merging into the Lord. Maharaj Yudhishthir also asked why Shishupal and Dantavakra were saved, while other demoniac persons who have blasphemed the Lord go to hell, such as King Venu. To answer these questions, we have to make the distinction between persons who are demoniac in general and the demons that appear in Krishna Lila. Krishna deals with both impartially, but if we don't see the difference, it seems as if he's sending some demons to hell and favoring some by giving them liberation, which would make him partial. Generally, jivas who are primarily acting under the modes of passion and ignorance, Krishna deals with indirectly through his energies of Maya and Kala in accordance with each jiva's karma. As for the demons in his pastimes, he is directly associating with them in accordance to how they are approaching him. So, first I'm going to talk about the first category, people who are just demoniac and aren't necessarily approaching Krishna, but they just are in the lower modes of nature, and thus, you know, by the law of karma, they're going to be dealt with. So in Bhagavad Gita chapter 16, verse 19 and 20, Krishna says, "Those who are envious and mischievous, who are among the lowest, who are the lowest among men, I perpetually cast into the ocean of material existence, into the various demoniac species of life, attaining repeated birth amongst the species of demoniac life, O son of Kunti. Such persons can never approach me. Gradually, they sink down to the most abominable type of existence." Excuse me. When I first heard this verse, I couldn't help but think it sounded like something out of the Old Testament, that God is an angry and vengeful, all-powerful judge who casts sinners into eternal damnation. But we should understand that Krishna, in his two-armed form, is not personally casting the envious and sinful persons into demoniac species of life. This is happening by the Lord's energies in accordance with the karmic reactions of the jiva, who is acting against scripture and performing vikarma, or sinful activities. The law of karma is absolute and fair. Actions have reactions, and the jiva does have choice. Although the jiva is influenced by his samskaras and the modes of nature, he is said to have will. According to the modes acting upon him, his will is restricted, but the jiva is said to be conscious by nature and to have the potential to know, will, and act. A jiva embodied as a demigod, human, animal, or plant is embodied by his will and karma. The Lord is not personally responsible, although he is the efficient cause of everything. Likewise, the pleasures and pains experienced by the jiva, although they could not happen without the sanctioning of the Lord, are not caused by the Lord directly. In Bhagavad Gita 4, chapter 4:14, Prabhupada cites the Vedanta Sutra 2.1.34. The Lord is never partial to any living entity. The living entity is responsible for his own actions. The Lord only gives him facilities through the agency of material nature, the external energy. Since time immemorial, the conditioned souls have gone from the highest forms of life to the lowest. Everyone gets to ride on the Ferris wheel of samskara.
Jai always gives the analogy of the Ferris wheel. Like, you know, you're down in ignorance, and you go up through passion, and then you're at the top, and you're in the mode of goodness, yay, you know. But eventually, you're going to fall down unless you transcend.
So, the Lord may seem to favor and reward a jiva in this life, and in another life, he may seem to dislike and punish that same jiva, but this is merely appearance, and is all in accordance with that jiva's will and karma. So to go back to Maharaj Yudhisthira's question, if the Lord is impartially punishing the demons, why do some demons get punished and others receive liberation? The answer is Krishna does not arbitrarily give liberation to some demons. Only when they approach him as the sole object of their mental absorption through enmity or fear does Krishna take notice and reciprocate. In chapter 4, verse 11, Krishna states, "As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects." So everyone is surrendered to Krishna from the oneness or abheda perspective. Even the woman pulling into McDonald's across the street, she's indirectly surrendered to Krishna's external energy, Maya, in the form of a Big Mac. And she's being rewarded accordingly by accumulating bad karma. Now from the bade or the difference perspective, those who wish to approach the Lord himself are rewarded accordingly by receiving his personal attention and by attaining an eternal spiritual result. So there's different ways of looking at Krishna. You have to define your term. When you say Krishna, you could mean everything, because he is the source of everything. Everything is within Krishna. And that's the oneness. From the other perspective, the difference, Krishna is a personality. He's a person. And everything is his energy, his expansions coming from him. So that's the chinta beta beta tattva. So in a sense, everyone is surrendered to Krishna. So in Brahma Samhita, chapter 5, text 55, it states, "I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, the meditators of whom, by meditating upon him under the sway of wrath, amorous passion, natural friendly love, fear, parental affection, delusion, reverence, and willing service, attain to bodily forms befitting the nature of their contemplation. As one approaches Krishna, he reciprocates accordingly. Just because jivas receive different results does not make him partial, but facilitates diversity and unity for the pleasure of himself and those who approach him. Being completely absorbed in Krishna in a particular mood, one will attain a transcendental position that corresponds with that mood." I mean, this is like a rough, you know, idea. It's more complex than that, of course. "For those completely absorbed in Krishna as a servant, parent, friend, or lover, they attain a spiritual body, siddhideya, that will facilitate them being able to reciprocate love with Krishna in that way. So in the case of the demons of Krishna Lila, these souls are approaching Krishna fully absorbed in him, in the emotions of fear or enmity, and Krishna mercifully responds by giving them liberation. This truly speaks of how merciful Krishna is, for Krishna is the only form in which this quality of complete reciprocity is manifest. Sri Jiva Goswami states in Krishna Sandarbha 29.96, "By killing and liberating these demons, Lord Krishna reveals his transcendental opulence, greater than the opulences of any other form of personality of Godhead." So Jiva Goswami makes like a really in-depth argument for Krishna being the Supreme Person of Godhead. Like Krishnanam was saying in his class, I think he got this idea from you, that Lord Ram and Nishinga have all 64 qualities of Krishna. And that's stated in the Samdarbha. But then he follows it up by saying, giving this example. So Jaya and Vijaya incarnated three times. They incarnated as Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha, as Ravana and his brother, I forget the name, and as Shishupal and Dantavakra. So Nishinga kills Hiranyakashipu, and Ram kills Ravana. But in those cases, they didn't
attain liberation. Only when Krishna killed Shishupal did he get liberation. So Jiva Goswami is using this to say, Krishna is the only one who has this quality of giving liberation to those. And also, even the demons, even by killing the demons. So that was really interesting. And I found an excerpt from a Prabhupada lecture on the same topic, which I really liked. It was really sweet. So this is it. Quote, "So the appearance and disappearance of the Lord within this material world is called Chakirishitam, pastimes. It is Krishna's pastimes that he comes. When he comes, he works. The work is to protect the sadhu and to kill the asadhu. Yet both activities are his pastimes. He is not envious. He cannot be envious. The killing of the demons is also his affection. Just like sometimes we punish our children, there is love. So when Krishna kills a demon, the business is not on the platform of material jealousy or enviousness." So it might seem like being a demon in Krishna Lila isn't so bad. In fact, since we're so demonic already, why don't we just aim for being a demon, right? You know, it seems like it makes sense. And in fact, Narada is going to praise the demons in the upcoming verse by stating, "By devotional service, one cannot achieve such intense absorption in thought of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as one can through enmity towards him. This is my opinion." So that's a really strong statement. Basically, he's saying these demons have something higher than devotional service. So we have to like look at that statement closer, because that's not the case. So Prabhupada is quick to explain that Narada, being a pure devotee, is apt to think himself lower than the lowest and to always glorify others. So he's glorifying them. Because, you know, devotees are always sweet and humble. he also says, Prabhupada also says, "One should not imitate Hiranyakashipu or Shishupal. This is not the way to achieve success. Bhakti yoga means one should serve Krishna favorably, or very favorably." I'm going to cover this point a little bit later in depth. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur also adds that while enmity has the power to produce quick absorption in the Lord, the demon's approach to Krishna is inferior to the path of bhakti. So in that verse, Narada is really glorifying the quickness and the depth of the demon's absorption, but he's not advocating it as a path that you should follow the demons. The demon's position is not as simple as just thinking of the Lord with hostility. There must be full and continuous absorption of the mind upon Krishna in the particular mood. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur states, "Continuous enmity should be there, and this produces complete absorption in the Lord. Weak enmity is excluded. In fact, if one doesn't have complete absorption, by thinking negatively of Krishna or the Lord, he will accrue bad karma. To foster negative sentiments towards the Lord is not a scripturally established spiritual practice for attaining transcendence, and to try would most likely lead one straight to hell." And Rupa Goswami writes in the Laghu Bhagavatamrita, in relation to those Bhagavad Gita verses where Krishna is saying, "I cast them into the wombs of demons and they'll never attain me, they'll never approach me." So in relation to those verses, he's saying Krishna is saying something else. So he's saying, hold on one second. He says, Krishna is saying, in addition to those verses, "If those who hate me do not come in contact with me in my form as Krishna, they will certainly take birth in very low species." So to be absorbed in negativity towards Krishna is very dangerous, because one needs personal association of the Lord. And if not, he's just going to fall down. In fact, it is said that simply by hearing the Lord being blasphemed, a devotee can fall down. So clearly this is not something we should try to emulate. So...
that if you're going to have a demoniac mentality towards Krishna, it should be absolute.
There's no room for any other thoughts. It has to be complete. He's the only object of your thought. Mm-hmm. You're completely absorbed in Krishna.
And that'll get you liberation.
That will give you liberation. But you can't just try to do that. It's not, because you'll fall down before you actually can get to that point. So the point is that I'm going to touch on this later, that the demons aren't just randomly appearing in the Leela just because they're, you know, thinking of Krishna negatively. There's specific past lives of these demons, and I've I have like printed out a few of them, and we're going to read some. I feel like I wrote more, but I guess I'm almost done here. All right. So, the result of being a demon is also undesirable. There are five types of mukti mentioned in the scriptures. They are salokya, which is being promoted to the realm of God, samipya, or becoming an associate of God, sarupya, attaining a form like that of God, sarshti, attaining opulences like that of God, and sayuja, merging into the effulgence of God. So in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 29, Text 13, it says, a pure devotee does not accept any kind of liberation, salokya, sarshti, samipya, sarupya, or ekatva, which is another word for sayuja, even though they are offered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the pure devotee only wishes for prema, to please the Lord and love him with no ulterior motive. Anything but Krishna in Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, or Madhurya Ras is highly undesirable to the Gaudiya Vaishnav. The demons generally only attain Sayuja and rarely go to Vaikuntha, in some cases, but there's a pass to that. And in the special case of Putana, she actually got Braj Bhakti, but we're going to read her past life and understand that. It wasn't just random. She had already fostered these feelings towards the Lord in that particular rasa. So Rupa Goswami defines pure devotional service, or Uttama Bhakti, in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.1.11, as when first class devotional service develops, one must be devoid of all material desires, knowledge attained by monistic philosophy, and fruit of action. The devotee must constantly serve Krishna favorably as Krishna desires. So the word anukulyena, or favorableness, is used specifically because complete absorption in Krishna is not the only qualification for pure devotional service. The pure devotee is free from all hostility or negative sentiments towards Krishna, and his only desire is to please Krishna, as Krishna would want to be pleased. So in this way, the demons are instantly disqualified from bhakti. In fact, in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, this verse by Narada is quoted. See, the verse from the Brahma Samhita I quoted, talking about how you can approach Krishna with full absorption in different rasas, Narada Muni is actually going to speak two verses that are very similar to that. And those verses are quoted in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, because he's using this to explain what is bhakti and what's not bhakti. So it's clear the demons are not real bhaktas, from our standpoint. So this is the final paragraph. The demons of Krishna Lila do not appear randomly, nor do they appear merely by having negative feelings towards Krishna. Some were not even demons in a past life. By the association of the Lord and his devotees, these jivas received blessings which allowed them to take birth in Krishna Lila and ultimately receive liberation. The story of the past lives of the demons can be found in the Garga Samhita. And so I have past lives of three different demons who eventually ended up in Krishna Lila. I was wondering if you guys could read them just to keep yourselves engaged and so I don't have to read as much.
The past life of Putana. Long ago, when Bali Maharaj conquered the entire universe and became the king of heaven ruling over all the planetary systems, Lord Vamanadeva appeared in Bali Maharaj's sacrificial arena in order to cheat him, Bali Maharaj, of his kingdom and return it to the demigods who were the rightful owners. When Lord Vamanadeva appeared in that assembly, Ratnamala, the daughter of Maharaj Bali, saw him and manifested a love for him as she would for her own son. Ratnamala thought, how wonderful it would be to have a son like him. If I had a son like him, then I could give him my breast milk to drink. Seeing his beautiful smiling face like that would make me very happy. Lord Vamanadeva, understanding the pure desire of the daughter of his great devotee, Bali Maharaj, Ratnamala. Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess she is. So
she's a devotee.
Yeah, she is. That's right. Lord Vamanadeva, understanding the pure desire of the daughter of his great devotee, Ratnamala. So then it should say the pure desire of Ratnamala, not the daughter of his great devotee, Ratnamala. That's why I got confused.
Oh, okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
that's
why
I got confused. I got thrown off. So he's referring to Ratnamala. Within himself awarded her the daughter of his great devotee, Bali Maharaj, the benediction she desired. Therefore, at the end of Dwapara Yuga, she became Putana, who by receiving the touch of the Lord and offering him her breast milk to suck, was awarded her innermost desire. Okay, so, Manoj, you want to read this next one?
Oh, I already handed out the sheets. It doesn't matter.
In the former birth, Vyalmasura was a great king named Bhimarata, who lived in the city of Varanasi, and who was expert at archery, very charitable, performed many sacrifices, and who was a great devotee of Lord Vishnu. Like other great devoted kings, he eventually gave up his kingdom to his son, and renouncing everything, went to the Malaya Hills, where he performed austerities for 100,000 years. Wow. A lot of years. The king, although a great renouncer of the world, had not yet conquered his pride, and thus when the sage Pulastya Muni came to his ashram accompanied by many disciples, the king sage neither stood up nor bowed down to receive him. Pulastya cursed the king to become a demon. When the king heard this, he fell down at the feet of the sage in full surrender, and the sage, the friend of the fallen and very kind to those who suffered, gave him the benediction that in the forest of Vrindavan, during the pastimes of Lord Krishna, he would be killed by the Lord and attain the destination desired by all the yogis. Thus King Bhimarata became the son of the demon Mayasura and was killed by the powerful arms of Lord Sri Krishna.
The past life of Agasura. So that's the big snake demon, right?
Mm-hmm. All the boys.
He swallows all the boys, the cowherd boys. Agasura was the demon Sankachuta's son. He was young, strong, and handsome, like a second Kamadeva. The sage Astavakra was very powerful and advanced, but he had a body which was disfigured. Aga, being puffed up by his material opulence and beautiful body, laughed when he saw the sage and said, "Who is this ugly person?" Hearing this, the sage cursed Agha to become the ugliest snake on earth. Agha realized that he had made a serious mistake, and he fell at the feet of the sage, his pride and arrogance finished. Seeing this action by the demon, the sage became pleased with him and decided to give him a benediction. The sage said that when Sri Krishna, who is far more beautiful than millions of cupids, enters the stomach of Agha, he will then become freed from the form of a snake. Thus, by the curse of Astavakra, Agasura became a snake, and by the sage's blessing, he attained a liberation unobtainable by the demigods.
All right. So that's about everything I have. I guess I have some extra time. So I did want to talk about Jaya and Vijaya, which Prabhupada mentions in text 20, if I'm not boring you guys too much. You sure? Because you look pretty bored. Okay. All right. Oh, and one more point that I wanted to mention in relation to the demons. This is really kind of interesting little fact I found that Baladeva Vijayabhushan in his Vedanta Sutras commentary, he mentions that when Krishna kills these demons with his chakra, it slays not only their material body but their subtle body, and then in those moments of death, the coverings that are blocking them from seeing Krishna for who he is and how beautiful he truly is, those are removed, and so they can really see Krishna, and they just, you know, they see him as the object of their affection or the Supreme Lord. So I thought that was pretty cool. So just briefly talk about Jaya and Vijaya. They're completely different than the demons in Krishna Lila, the other demons, because they actually are prima bhaktas, and they come down to facilitate pastimes with Lord Vishnu and Lord Krishna. They were cursed by the Kumaras. They were originally doorkeepers in Vaikuntha. They guarded the seventh gate. So there's 7 gates to get into Vaikuntha, and it's said that they can represent the different stages of sadhana bhakti. So these kumaras are kind of like gyanis. They're very mixed with gyanis. We were talking last night in Jaya's class that they're in Shantaras, right? So they didn't fully understand like the Vaikuntha. And so they went through the first 6 gates easily. And then they got stopped by Jaya and Vijaya. And there was a confrontation. And the kumaras cursed them, not realizing the exalted position of the devotees of Lord Vishnu. So Lord Vishnu... Well, Lakshmi got Lord Vishnu to go out and said that Lakshmi was like, there's a noise at the door, go get it. Gerald, there's some Kumaras at the door, go get the door. So Vishnu comes and he says, I can see that I have offended you. And by his statement, by saying it like that, the Kumaras could understand that Krishna's devotees, I mean, Vishnu's devotees and himself are non-different in a sense, and that he sees himself as his devotees as part of him almost. Like, you know, there's such an intimate, loving connection there that he's like, oh, I've offended you. You know, I've offended you personally, you know, through my doorkeepers. So it's explained, Prabhupada, this isn't like a controversial topic or anything, like Prabhupada is very clear in his purports that Jaya and Vijaya never really came under the modes of material nature fully. They're facilitating Viraras, which is like the fighting bhav between Vishnu and his devotees. So they're really coming to facilitate pastimes with him. And that's like how deep the connection between Krishna, the Lord and his devotees are. They felt that he wanted to experience this rasa. And so they personally fell to the material world. But it wasn't like falling like we would think of falling. It's more like a stage fall, like you're seeing a play and someone falls off a building in the play and everyone in the audience is like, oh my gosh, you know. But really there's like a harness, you know, they're perfectly safe, it's all a part of the show, you know. So I thought that was really interesting. Anyways, I think that's about everything I have to say. I can't really think of anything else. I guess I can try to take questions. I mean, this information is just stuff I've found from the Acharya, so I don't actually have any real understanding. So,
or it's just a comment.
Okay.
Well, thank you for a very nice class.
You're welcome.
I particularly like the point that Krishna personally interacts with the demons. That doesn't mean he personally interacts with the demoniac. I hadn't really heard that before. I really appreciate that point. But also, you know, I've heard that Lord Nityananda is even more merciful than Lord Chaitanya. Is that correct? So, you know, the pastime of Jagai and Madai.
Oh, yeah, that's Jaya and Vijaya, too. Uh-huh. That's the fourth time they came.
Krishna himself is about to kill them, and Lord Nityananda stops him and always thought, so he's more merciful because he saves their bodies? That didn't make much sense to me, but now it makes sense that... Mm. What he's doing is he's preventing Lord Krishna from killing them with his Sudarshana Chakra, because that would award them impersonal liberation.
Probably, yeah.
Instead, he's offering them bhakti, which is like so much of a greater benediction. Mm-hmm. That's just a realization I had while you were speaking.
Yeah.
That was very nice.
Yeah, it was really sweet. And it seems like it's by the grace of Krishna's devotees that these demons even get introduced to Leela, like in these past lives we're reading about, it seems like devotees have given demons benedictions, or they've somehow been introduced through other devotees to the Lord. So it's not like the Lord just goes out and picks demons like, hey, you know, you reciprocate to me. Because bhakti is given by bhakti, not by Krishna directly, necessarily. It's his devotees that distribute bhakti. So that it's Krishna's still impartial, always. So... I don't know about the specifics of how Jaya and Vijaya became Jagai and Madai, because because it says that they merge into... Because it was really confusing when I first read it. It was like they merge into Krishna's body, and then they stay there for a while. They just hang out for a little bit, and then they go back to Vaikuntha. So I don't know how it really works, you know, how they... they come back down again somehow, and then they get, you know, Braja Prema. So that would mean they're not in Vaikuntha anymore. I don't know that the specifics of that. It's an interesting question. That what? You've heard that. Yeah, I don't know the scriptural evidence of that. It's probably in CC somewhere, though. Really? Yeah, I hope it's not just a rumor. Another point is that I think Rupa Goswami says that that Jayan Vijay, it's not like Jayan Vijay fall down every time Krishna manifests. He says that they fell once, and then conditioned jivas take the roles of these different demons, like Ravana and so on and so forth, Shishupal. It's not that they fall every single time. They're going back and forth, you know. Yeah, exactly. It's not like, you know, they're at the gates of Vaikuntha, like, oh, gotta go to my other job, you know, time to fall now. So I thought that was interesting. So when they say that Jai and Vijay are Jagai and Madai, I don't know if that's literal or if that it's like in the other cases where a jiva would take the role of Jayan Vijay, and it's like an archetype, you know, of the evil brothers that appear. But I really have no idea. You know, I haven't done that much extensive research into these topics. So
it was Madhavanandapu, who is a disciple of Guru Govinda Maharaj. He was narrating a pastime one time. I forget the demon's name he was narrating, but basically the pastime goes that this particular demon created a big ruckus in Krishna Leela, and he even grabbed Radharani by the hair, and which is a little surprising. How could a demon touch Radharani? And when he went back into the story, he revealed how actually this demon was Subal, Radharani's brother.
Oh.
And because of having lost a wager in a particular earlier pastime, then he was cursed to be a demon. So It's really interesting. I just thought it's an interesting point. When your class was really nice, it brings to light a very nice idea that to understand why things are happening, you know, just from our limited perspective, can be oftentimes very compromising, because we might think that God is black or white, but really we see here that Krishna is very, that in all situations he's very merciful, and it's not that he's, you know, punishing or rewarding, but rather in the case of the demoniac, he's letting them get the due reactions of their activities, and in the case of the demons, he's giving them, because they've thought of him. Jaya likes to make this point that meditation on Bhagavan is extremely potent as a sadhana. So for even the demons, that meditation on Bhagavan gives a reward, you know, even though of liberation. So how wonderful is this principle of meditating on God? What to speak of when you do it with affection, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's beautiful because it's so different than other spiritual paths in that respect. Because most Eastern spiritual traditions, it's like you're trying to, it's all about getting away from material nature, undoing all the samskaras, you know, coming to zero from a negative number. It's about becoming free of the material nature, and it's not really, the goal isn't that clear. It's, you know, neti, neti, not this, not this. So in bhakti, it's so beautiful because it doesn't matter how conditioned you are, this or that. It's all about Krishna. It's focused on Krishna. It's about going from negative to positive to infinity, you know. It's like, you know, approach infinity by loving Krishna. And there's like a goal. It's a defined goal, you know. Whereas, you know, you're moving towards something. You're moving towards Krishna. You know, versus moving away from suffering. So it's yeah. Yeah, and it happens, that's happening as like a secondary feature of the bhakti process, so. Yeah, probably. Come on, man.
Alright, well, especially in this pastime that I read, it said he's a great devotee of Lord Vishnu, and then he was killed as a demon in his next life. So I'm wondering how it works if they're a devotee of Vishnu or Krishna, they have a personal conception of God at one point, and then they go into Brahman effulgence. That seems like, you know, why, that seems like terrible.
Yeah.
Like, why would, is that allowed to happen if they have a personal conception and then they go merge with the effulgence? So I'm just wondering if anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I'll try to answer that, because I'm not sure if just being a devotee of Lord Vishnu necessarily entails that you're, you know, meditating on a personal relationship with him. You know, I mean, there's a lot of devotees of Vishnu in India, you know, but they're not all Gaudiya Vaishnavs. They're not all, you know. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I honestly, I'm not sure. Himanshu? It's a good question.
Mada and then get the fruit of that personal practice they'd already cultivated. Maybe, I don't know, but I haven't heard anything. I don't think we should.
Yeah, let's not speculate too much on that.
But
make
it's a nice
note
question.
Of that point. It's a good point. Anybody else? It's a good Jaya question. All right, guys, I think that's it. Let's wrap it up. Srila Prabhupada ki. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Thanks, man.